trumpet started blowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet on Tuesday, February 25th at 6 p.m.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KABU's membership drive, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning to KBOO Portland. We're going to jump right into Radio Zine, where Suzanne LeGrand talks with Pamela Newkirk.
This is Radio Zine. I am Suzanne LeGrand. Today my guest is Professor Pamela Newkirk, award-winning journalist, professor at NYU, and author of the recently published book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Welcome.
Thank you.
To begin, I'm wondering if you could explain how the call for greater diversity and inclusion became a billion-dollar business.
Yeah, so to start with, the reason why I wrote this book is because throughout my career, both in daily journalism and then for the past 25 years on the faculty of New York University, diversity has been sort of a preoccupation both in the news industry and in the academy. And yet, for all of the talk about diversity and for all of the consultants and diversity czars and training programs and climate surveys and on, the billions of dollars that are spent on diversity efforts, the needle on racial diversity in most elite institutions has barely moved over the past three, four decades. So I wanted to look at that tension between all of the billions expended on diversity and the lack of diversity in most of these elite institutions, and that includes, of course, the news media and universities, colleges, film, fashion, Hollywood, you name it, diversity is really not a reality in most institutions in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that most of these institutions, both public, private, you mentioned media, also educational mm-hmm. institutions, mm-hmm. recognize that there's a problem.
Right. And the thing that I found really striking is that the institutions or the fields that are considered the most progressive, news media, higher ed, film, fashion, are the least diverse. And the most diverse is corporate America. So that was oh. probably one of the most surprising findings.
I'm curious, what is it that people see as the problem? And I'm wondering also if that defines what solutions are proposed. I mean, corporations must recognize that if they don't have a diverse workforce, that is actually a problem for the growth of business.
Right.
Do they recognize that?
I think so. I think they see it more as a bottom line issue. And of course, because corporate America has far more jobs than most elite institutions have. They have more jobs to fill. They have more spaces to fill. So they have to be a lot more competitive, and that's why they end up having more diversity.
So
and that's not to say they don't have a problem too. Mm-hmm, but corporate mm-hmm. America is far more diverse than say most colleges and universities or the news media or publishing or all of these other fields.
So what happens in one of these diversity programs typically?
Well, one of the things that companies spend millions of dollars on each year is diversity training, and many have mandatory diversity training, and just about every major study over in recent years, including a pretty influential one done by Professor Dobbins at Harvard, shows that most of these programs either don't work or, in the case of mandatory training, make the problem worse. They find that institutions that impose mandatory training, the numbers of people of color, particularly African-American and Asian women, the numbers actually go down after like a year after mandatory training, because they often stoke a backlash, particularly among white men who see it as punitive and, you know, sort of like a blaming game. And so they trigger a lot of resentment. And yet, most companies continue, that's like a default, you know, instead of actually increasing diversity, they do these programs and they hire these czars and they do everything but hire a more diverse workforce.
So one very fundamental issue is hiring. Right. That part isn't rocket science.
That's the novel idea that I came up with. Oh, you can actually hire more people of color, and then you'd have more diversity. I just find it kind of stunning that even in New York City, I can go to so many events related to publishing or journalism or higher ed, where you can have 100 people and I could be the only African American in the room. These are such exclusive, homogenous fields, and I don't think many even recognize the extent to which they're homogenous and exclusionary. And so I think we've somehow normalized the lack of diversity to the point where having diversity is just so like, like what? Like, I just don't think it's even considered something that you actually have to do. It's like easier to talk about it or to say that, you know, we're progressive, so like, why do we need diversity? Which I've heard, actually. I've heard someone in publishing say, well, we're publishing these diverse books, so it's not like it makes a difference. It's like,
wow, this is so interesting.
Yeah.
So
it is.
The training programs are obviously failing because people are believing that they're doing due diligence when nothing's changing, it sounds like.
Right, but it's like checking a box. It's like what one of the people I interviewed, Cyrus Murray, who litigated many of the landmark discrimination lawsuits, one against Coca-Cola, and basically he calls it drive-by diversity. You know, he sort of like your due diligence. You have your training, you have your diversities, check. You know, you do a climate survey, and then, you know, you did diversity instead of actually implementing diversity.
So do you think people are acting in bad faith here, that they are on one hand wanting diversity but actually not really wanting diversity?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. You know, it's hard, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and I haven't put people on the couch. I can only look at what is. But if you keep doing the same thing and it doesn't bear fruit and you keep doing it, it does lead me to question how serious you are about doing this thing. If a company is not making money by doing something over and over that's not effective, usually they would change course because it's the bottom line, right? They want to succeed. And I think the same is true. If you really want diversity, there are a number of successful models that you could begin to mimic. But to keep doing the same thing and not getting results, it does lead me to question the sincerity, the goodwill of those institutions.
In the book, you give the following information about Google. They have spent upwards of $265 million to diversify their workforce, and yet
a year.
Oh my goodness, a year. Okay, and yet the average percentage of Black employees hovers at 2%. Now, right. If this was any other business, people would say, this is not working.
Exactly. Yeah, I just don't think there's a real incentive for many of these institutions to actually implement diversity, because it would not be rocket science. I also provide numbers showing how many people of color are graduating with degrees in computer science and engineering. It's no longer, I mean, for many decades, the problem was the pipeline. But now the problem seems to be that these people are not being hired at the same rate as others. So, and even if the problem was the pipeline, instead of spending millions each year or hundreds of millions each year on failed policies, why not spend that money on increasing the pipeline through programs, training programs, scholarships to engineering and computer science. But like, there are other things you can do if you actually wanted to increase diversity. But to keep doing the same thing and expecting different results is either a sign of insanity or a sign of you're not really motivated to move the needle.
Can you talk a little bit about what the lack of motivation is coming from? I mean, obviously it's affecting the bottom line and it's costing companies, private companies, a lot of money. I imagine public ones as well.
Well, I don't know if it's affecting the bottom line to the extent. There had been studies, I think for like about 10 years it was kind of trendy to try to convince companies that diversity was good for the bottom line. And then other studies show that it really doesn't change the bottom line. So that's sort of at a, you know, stalemate, whether or not it does or doesn't. So without that as a motivating factor, you would just need, you know, basic principles of justice and equality to motivate you to do that. And I so far we haven't seen where that is the operating principle of many of these institutions. And usually what it takes is some kind of embarrassing episode. You know, I wrote about how, like, it's almost like a dance where there's some public embarrassment, like at Starbucks, you know, when two African-American customers were arrested for sitting down and trying to mm-hmm. have their coffee, and they ended up in handcuffs. And so what do? They go and hire a diversity czar, and they make these public pronouncements. In Starbucks' case, they closed hundreds of stores to have a one-day training session. And so this is the dance. Gucci, they had an embarrassing episode. They did pretty much the same thing. They hired a high-profile diversity czar. They enlisted a famous black film director to be the face of the company. So this is what's done. It's like these public relations kind of ploys that operate as the answer to the lack of diversity instead of actually tackling the lack of diversity in the workforce. So I think too often diversity is seen less as a moral imperative or, you know, just a basic issue of fairness, and it's seen more as a public relations issue or as a legal issue. You know, something, you know, if you have diversity czars and you have a diversity program, that might shield you from a lawsuit, you know, from having to pay a lawsuit. So these kind of public actions are how many institutions are operating instead of, like, really seriously tackling diversity in the workplace.
Would it be fair to say that it's really about cleaning up or rehabilitating image rather than about making systemic changes?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, mm-hmm. that they're more interested in sort of the public relations aspect of diversity than they seem to be about actually increasing diversity in the workplace. And, you know, of course, this doesn't speak for everyone. Mm-hmm. I looked at Columbia University, where Lee Bollinger, the president, has made diversity a real priority for that institution. And even though there have been, you know, good years and bad years on this front, you can see that there's real effort and the needle has moved. You know, I looked at Coca-Cola, you know, after the discrimination lawsuit and settlement, they actually implemented systems that created systemic change. So there are models that, as I say, can be replicated. This is not rocket science. It's not something that's just too difficult to conquer for those institutions that are really serious about this. They can look at those two cases and others where the needle has moved.
In the case of Coca-Cola and also Columbia, what were some of the things that they implemented that actually did make a difference?
Well, I think, first of all, they didn't farm it out to diversity czars. It was integrated into the mainframe of the institution. Oftentimes, you know, when institutions hire diversity czars and they implement these programs, leadership is sort of like these people in these programs are pretty much marginalized in the institution. They're not integrated into the core, into the mainframe of the organization. We're at Coca-Cola and at Columbia University, people had to answer to the top people.
So there was a system of accountability?
Yes, there was accountability. It wasn't farmed out. It was like, you know, the buck stopped with the head person, and it's the only way. These issues are not going to happen bottom up. It has to come from the top.
You mentioned one other problem, which is with some of these companies that do diversity training, which you said that the space was flooded with people who are doing this work, but many of them don't put the work in a historical context. We're not good at knowing history, one person said.
Right. Well, you know, that's part of it. It's like this work is done in a vacuum, as if, you know, the history of race in this country is immaterial to the work of diversity. It's like, why do we even have this problem? And what is it stemming from? Like, we have a country in which race has always operated either been, you know, under the radar or even on top of the radar. It's always been an issue in this country, and we go about this work of diversity as if that's not something that is systemic to, it's the air we breathe, you know, these notions of racial superiority, racial inferiority. So to have a training program, it sort of like assumes that you can tackle something that's so systemic in our society through a 1 hour, 2 hour, or even a full day of training. Mm-hmm. It's so much bigger than that. So while, you know, even if these training programs worked, that is not going to resolve the issue of diversity. Companies or institutions have to figure out ways to increase diversity, whether or not people are trained to respect people of other races or not. Like, how you feel about people in the workplace should not, we shouldn't have to change racial attitudes in society in order to increase diversity. Mm-hmm. You know, because discrimination, first of all, is against the law. And secondly, if you really value diversity, you have to get beyond the issue of feelings, how people feel about different races. And I'm not convinced that these training programs can actually really move the needle on racial attitudes. But with leadership, even with these racial attitudes, you can increase diversity.
What would true diversity and inclusion in a workplace look like, in your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you what it doesn't look like. So in a country that where people of color are close to 40% of the population, you have fields like higher ed, where African Americans are 4% of university and college professors, and Latinos are 3%, and that they're so disproportionately underrepresented. So we're talking about just acute underrepresentation. So while you may not get at proportional representation across the board in every field, certainly when you have that kind of acute underrepresentation, you have something is wrong, especially when you can show that you have a pipeline. You have a pool of people who are qualified for these jobs who are not getting them. So, you know, most of the problems exist in the most elite fields because they're the ones that are most likely to function with systems of nepotism, smaller spheres of friendships, and, you know, it's like this little world from which they're selecting, and so it's a self, you know, perpetuating kind of self-replicating kind of operation. In corporate America, many have anti-nepotism rules. They have all kind of systems that prevent that kind of, you know, self-replication. And you know, when we're looking at these fields like fashion, why should fashion be so disproportionately white in a country where people of color are 40% of the population, and I think they hold like 11% of like board seats in the fashion industry. So whether we're talking about creative fields, scientific fields, no matter which way you slice it, people of color are just like not part of the equation. Hollywood, you know. So we're not only talking about fields in which require high levels of education. A lot of times we're talking about creative fields where people of color are still disproportionately underrepresented. So to your question, what does a diverse room or field look like? You have to start by looking at the representation, the proportionality of those people, and then look at how represented they are in these fields. And so when we're looking at so many fields, whether it's, you know, academia or publishing, or, you know, you're looking across the board at fields where people of color are just so radically underrepresented. We're not even close to our representation in the population.
You mentioned this, but I just want to highlight this, that we have plenty of people who are qualified, but they're not making it into through the hiring process.
Right.
And part of this, it seems from what you've been saying, is that institutions tend to hire people that they already know, which
yep.
means that they're hiring within their social
their
circle and
exactly.
also their cultural values, right? So that's part of the problem in
that's
terms
part
of
it. And then you add on to that just impressions that many whites have of African Americans and Latinos that's baked into the psyche of this country based on centuries of demeaning depictions of people of color, both in history books and science, you know, all the race science that up until the 1950s really was still pretty prevalent in you know, major colleges and universities like Harvard and Princeton and Yale. So this is like something that these ideas of who and what people are based on race are so deeply embedded in our national, just the way we function, that until we begin to address that, and when I say we, you know, since institutions, the higher ed, is responsible for so many of these ideas that still permeate, you know, our society, I think that's where some of the leadership has to begin to kind of dismantle this ideology that has really gone unchallenged in a meaningful way.
You said towards the end of your book, and I think this speaks to the point that you're talking about now, you said racial diversity will only be achieved once white America is weaned off a prevailing narrative of racial preeminence, a belief system as intoxicating and addictive and ultimately destructive as any opiate. So it seems that this idea about white racial superiority is part mm-hmm. of what really needs to be dismantled.
I think so. And I also think, like, why wouldn't that be a belief system based on everything we've seen in this country? And as I said, these ideas did not percolate from the bottom up. They came from the top. They came from leading academics. You know, it's enshrined in our the academy. And, you know, I don't think that the leadership in most colleges and universities have seriously confronted the legacy of these pernicious beliefs that operated as fact and as science I don't think that they've seriously confronted those ideas and begun to dismantle them. If anything, the silence has allowed that ideology to flourish.
So it's both that ideology and also the cultural illiteracy that you also discuss about recognizing that there is a longstanding cultural context and a lot to really understand about how we ended up where we are today, right?
Right. I mean, you know, one of the privileges of being white in America is not having to seriously consider the legacy of slavery, the legacy of, you know, Jim Crow laws, and all of these horrific systemic issues that people of color are still living with. And most white people don't have to consider those things. In fact, you know, until 2-3 years ago, until Trump's election, many were insisting that we lived in a post-race society. At least now, most people are not saying that anymore. I mean, we weren't post-race after Obama's election, and we're not post-race now. We've never truly overcome many of the systemic barriers to racial equality. So, if there's one thing that has come from the last few years is getting over that notion of being post-race, because I think that kind of blindness stands in the way of us actually confronting the problems in front of us.
Thanks so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine for KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
And yes, this is KBOO Portland, where the time is 10:31, and it's time for me to remind